Hello, and welcome to the Agile Embedded Podcast. I'm Jeff Gable.
And I'm Luca Gianni.
And today we are joined by Luca Mustafa. He's the founder and CEO of Earnus, a product development firm. He was a client of Luca's and intrigued us because he claimed that his company could iterate on hardware faster than they could on software. And that really piqued our interest. So Luca, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be part of it.
So we were talking before the show, since, you know, you have the same name as my co-host, a slightly different spelling, but, you were okay if we called you by your nickname, Musti. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's right. That's how you can find me online as well.
Sounds good. All right. So Musti, tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Perfect. So my name is Luca Mustafa, or as everyone is firm and otherwise call me Musti. So I've been developing hardware for about 10 years now. So really going in on the deep end straight after university and then starting Earnus as a company, building a wireless optical system to get us started. But actually in the process of that, got much better at developing things than the wireless optical market that did not really grow as fast as expected. So this turned out into a product development company. And the interesting part is, to be agile in the way we've done the wireless optical system, we've had to come up with all the resources and all the tooling to build things ourselves. And, you know, that restarted when 3D printing started and all of that. So we started massively scaling on what we can do in-house. And that today allows us to build prototypes and products with very fast iterations. And that really nicely matches with the agile way of working. And I guess that's why we're here today.
Absolutely. And tell us a little bit about that. I still want to know about that first call between you and Luca, where you told him that you were faster at iterating on hardware than you were on software.
Correct.
Just what was that experience like? And then since Luca's been helping you out, how has it changed?
So over the past year, pretty much we've been massively growing our firmware development team, particularly finding ways how to make them grow faster, getting them the right mentorship and the support. So we've started looking at improving the processes, the tooling, and pretty much all the ways to make the firmware development better. That was partly aligned with our strategic decision to only focus on Zephyr RTOS, kind of to, you know, create our own slice of what we do really there. Because we've been seeing in the past, we've, you know, happily jumped on any project, but you always learn too much things in a new project with a new technology, with a new processor and all that. So that makes you reasonably slow, as well as the lack of like really good tooling and best practices and processes. So we've actually reached out to Luca because we're looking always for the best possible mentors for our team to give us examples of working better, give us good practices, and you know, point us in the right direction. So we've reached out to a few people, each from, you know, a slightly different perspective, and have been working with many of them since to accelerate our internal growth, essentially.
Nice. Nice. So tell me about kind of that rapid hardware iteration. So I had heard the time period 2 weeks thrown around. So just to be clear, say you have a custom board or maybe a set of custom boards for a project. And do you have basically a fixed, like every 2 weeks something new comes out, or it's only if you need, like what, how does that typically work for a development project?
Right. So overall, we always strive to build the right thing for the client. The like overall challenge is the client doesn't know what is the best thing for them, and we don't know. So that's a bit of a discovery process as you go along in the product development. And the more things you can try, the better you know what works, what doesn't, what is a good fit. Like you need a hands-on experience. Particularly with the hardware and, you know, PCBs and mechanics, we've built our processes such that, you know, we have vertical CNC milling machines in-house, we have pick-and-place line and all of that. So when we need a board or a mechanical part, we can get it made almost instant. So really, with a two-week iteration time, we're limited by having a few days of board design time, sending it out to PCB manufacturing, which, you know, in good pre-COVID days could take up to 4 days or so, or over the weekend almost. Now it's a bit longer, but still we're within a good week or so. And when boards come through the door, they get assembled in minimal time, which is hours to a day or two. And then we can start testing it, see if it all runs fine, and already put things out there, see, here's a version of product. Does that work? And we've then needed firmware to follow as fast in that process. And that's quite the challenge, because usually the firmware is really the bottleneck. So that's what we wanted and also did get massively better over the past year. And there's obviously ways to go as well.
Nice. Yeah. So I think a key enabling technology or a capability that you have is doing all of the board assembly and machining, if necessary, in-house.
True. But like the overarching part we found is really on the organization side. So in-house, we do mechanics, electronics, firmware. We do software as well. So a bit of smartphone apps and a bit of cloud parts. So what we tell our clients is we build solutions to the cloud. So we'll make sure whatever we build talks to the cloud and has that component. We don't deal with the user front-facing, front end and that part. But the key part is not cutting collaboration with other people on a technological border. What I mean by that is if we develop a PCB and we're not part of the assembly process, we have no insights what's going on there. Does it go well? Are there troubles? We need to talk to someone. Someone needs to have time for us. And we've been working with external partners in the past. It took weeks to get somewhere. So we wanted to cut that down. And we did. On the mechanic side, we've actually from the start been doing things with printers in-house and then just massively grown the machines so we can build most of the things we do right now ourselves. But the trick was there that we want our engineers to go and use the machine and build the part that they're designing. So it's not the engineer drawing up plans, giving documentation, taking that to a workshop technician and making someone else understand what they need to manufacture and then come back, but they actually go and build it. So throughout the build process, they understand what goes well, what doesn't, and already think of the next version. And that's the model we then applied to firmware, software, and pretty much the rest. And that was quite an interesting challenge.
So what I'm hearing, though, is that all of this sounds quite expensive. You've got a lot of machines in-house. You're, quote-unquote, wasting a lot of valuable engineer's time fiddling with a machine. How is that still efficient for the customer?
So that's, firstly, you're not wasting engineer's time. Because engineers by nature, even if they're doing a seemingly repetitive task, need the chance to think through things, have a hands-on experience and try it out. And it's really hard to figure out all the errors in on paper or in CAD software, pretty much. So what our experience was, you do your due diligence there, but you're much sooner wrong if you just build the damn thing. So also on the PCB side, you can spend weeks in review with multiple people, all that, or you spend a week and build the board and measure things and see if it runs. And then it truly runs. If you do the checks on the paper, only things you've thought of will work. But when you get the real part, there's a chance you miss something and it still won't work. So the sooner you're wrong, the sooner you move on and progress to the next iteration. And this is pretty much like software. You write some lines, you run some tests, or you ship a product the agile way every few weeks, end of sprint, you see what you get back, and you move along. So it's exactly the same on hardware. Whereas previously we've seen, you might have like 3 board iterations with some clients we had in the past. Now we can do about 20 a year if needed. Obviously, you don't do that many per client because it's not needed. That's the pace you get.
That is impressive. Whenever I'm working with a new client, usually they're experienced enough to know what's going on, but sometimes I get a naive client that thinks, okay, we'll design the PCB and then you'll write the firmware and we'll be done. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no. you're guaranteed to find bad things. And so you'll have to, plan for at least 2 hardware revisions. But it's yeah, I have never ever talked to someone who has that rapid of a pace of everyone is like 8 weeks minimum, more like 12 weeks for a hardware revision. That's really amazing.
Sure. From my perspective, this means in 8 weeks or 12 weeks, you can only be wrong once throughout that process. Or you can be wrong, you know, 4 or 6 times or, you know, some number of times.
Right.
Yeah, it also feels to me that you can pull off being this fast because you're this fast. In other words, you know, it's such a regular thing for your engineers to spin a new board that, you know, there's not much guessing involved. There's not much fiddling involved. You know, you just do it, right?
Correct.
So,
yes.
So
we order boards like twice a week, pretty much.
Exactly. So sort of the virtue of being fast enables you to be even faster because you're just so used to working in this way and you know exactly how it works.
Correct. Yes. And well, from, you know, we've spoken to some other companies which don't have this capacity. So essentially they do super extensive checklists and like try to have the minimal amount of hardware iterations because then they take so long. From our perspective, that part is like, you know, building the aircraft kind of works, but you need a lot of time because testing things out is too expensive. Like, you know, you can't build too many prototypes that way. But particularly for the IoT and connected products, we're not solving just the technical challenges. Most of the time, we're asked to solve a technical challenge, but turns out we start solving a market fit challenge. So pushing the technology as far as possible, determining which features are too expensive to be built, and along the way, finding, you know, these are potential new features which might be easy enough to implement and give you better business value. And that kind of goes towards the specifications, which might sound a bit intriguing, but usually the customer is wrong in what they want. And usually we're wrong in what we think they want. So we all just need to be wrong faster until we converge to the right solution.
So so you're a product development firm. You're doing this work for clients who come to you with an idea and you kind of make it reality. How has it been kind of both in the past and now working with those clients in this fashion, in this highly iterative way? You know, what are some of the, how did that go in the beginning when you first started doing it? How is it going now? What are some of the roadblocks?
Right. So in the beginning, we started, you know, the usual way, you know, someone asks, we want this built. You draw up a quote, you know, multiply it by some factor and you go about building it. Usually then that ends up in us building the product anyway, all the way out for way more effort than we ever anticipated, because change management is really hard throughout the process. And over time, we learned that actually changes is what is happening by default. So instead of finding a process which limits the changes, we've created the agile process, which we use now, that inherently is suitable for changes. And we assume changes happen, which allows us to do two things. First one is, we can start working on the project with a single page of requirement documents, which are really high level. And secondly, we review and change direction every 2 weeks. So the kind of example I like to give, which is, you know, a standard agile example, is you can go one direction. You know, you imagine you fly a plane. You're off by 15 degrees towards where you're going. You fly 100 miles. You'll be way off your target and also out of fuel and out of budget. You just land there and, you know, you can't go further. Whereas if you every like 10 kilometers or whatever, change the direction for a degree, you will eventually, you know, converge to the right position and you will land there. So you'll be much closer to where you need to be, not versus where you believe you need to be going in the beginning.
So Musti, what you've been describing sounds eerily similar to the traditional way that software was released, where releases were this scary activity that was prone to problems and to breaks. And so you did it as rarely as possible. You know, you deployed 3 times a year. Everybody got pulled into the office over the weekend, and you kind of white-knuckled your way through this deployment, and you hoped you got it all back up and running by Monday morning. And of course, because it was so scary, people sort of retracted and said, no, we should do it even less. And that just made it all worse, didn't it? So it's quite funny to hear you talk about sort of a parallel experience, which, to be honest, I think for large parts of the industry is still the present state, right? A lot of hardware manufacturing, even, you know, in the prototype stage, is just really slow. And it gets slowed down even more because, you know, hardware iterations are scary. And so we should do them very carefully and hopefully not very many of them. And you're just taking the exact opposite approach.
Exactly. And, you know, we've also seen doing hardware iterations with external partners at this pace is not really viable. And like, even if you have the best partner in the world, which is, you know, one block away from you, they have their own business strategy. They have their own pipeline. They, you know, you call them, they need to put in the schedule. So it's always a few days. Plus you need to explain to someone what you want them to do. And if they have a question, they're not in the same office. They need to, you know, type an email or organize a meeting. So there's all of this overhead just to sort out things. And even if you have the best possible process, it will take time. Whereas in the office, what we do, if there's a, you know, I don't know, an issue with the pick and place file, one person talks to another person sitting at the next desk. So that's how it works. But also it's the way we've found to create our team. So we are, let's say, size limited at 16 engineers by design.
Sorry, 16?
16, so 1/6. Because that's like a flat level manageable team. It's like a, you know, an agile team of reasonable size as well. And what this does for us is we have enough people on board that we have multiples of each expertise. So people can go on vacation and, you know, have a normal life. So it's not always something on fire. And also they can share expertise, help things out, you know, do reviews, cross reviews and all that. And that makes things flow nicely. But also that we don't need to talk to anyone except, say, in hardware, buying supplies. So, you know, buy pieces of plastic, buy pieces of aluminum, order PCBs. But that's a fairly automated process. And the rest we control pretty much.
Just out of curiosity, how many support staff, like basically outside of engineering, not support staff, maybe that's a bad term for it, like non-engineering staff do you have in your company?
So we have various levels of expertise, and some of our colleagues are, well, let's say, taught the expertise in electronics or mechanics or product management, but the other overhead stuff, which is not engineering, is one person.
Wow.
In admin. All the rest is engineering. That's the configuration that works. So obviously you need the various levels because, you know, when you are, say, a very good expert in PCB design, you don't really want to be spending so much time assembling PCBs. So someone with less expertise at that point in their career will take that position for a few years and then kind of train up and so forth. Because also that's a valuable part of the process.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this a little bit more because so far we've been essentially focusing on only this one aspect of the entire product creation, right? Iterating in hardware. But how do you organize collaboration between the different specialties? Like, where do the mechanical design people come in? Where do the firmware programmers come in? And so on.
Sure. So, well, firstly, we run like an open design office so everyone can talk to everyone without any limitations. We are trying to nail this process now, and there's, internally, I would say there's a lot we don't know and the process is not ideal, but generally works well enough that we can work with the clients. So we organize our work in sprints, and we pretty much in the sprint kickoff design meeting bring in all the people that we need to build that. So mechanical, electrical, firmware, software, product design, whoever we need. And then we talk things out, draw things on the board until everyone is reasonably happy that they can do things for 2 weeks. In the right direction.
All right. So you don't have a fixed team per se, but you just sort of at the beginning of each sprint, pick up the people you will need for the next 2 weeks, and then they work together. And then potentially, you know, this particular group of people disbands and another one forms.
Correct. So what we see to a large extent is that we create a sprint, what we call like IRNA sprints method, which is our simplified way of doing agile, pretty much. is we say this sprint is like 2 to 3 weeks long and has so many man days of effort in there, and we assign the effort and the people from our pool of 16 engineers, however it best fits to that particular sprint. So if you need a PCB designer for a day, you get one for one day. If you need firmware for, I don't know, 10 days, there's someone. So usually we'll have like assigned roles. So someone is the lead hardware design for mechanics, electronics, and PCB for a project, and they follow through the project most of the time. And then other people will jump in and, you know, expand the effort in certain sprints or scale down or provide input or so. So it's really fluid. And that's a bit different than, you know, most agile teams where you have the team and that's the team and they run the whole sprint.
How many projects do you have running concurrently, typically?
Yeah, that's hard to answer, but can be up to 10. So,
and I guess some are a bit dormant and some are a bit more active, right?
Correct. So some are in the support phase, some are active sprints, but generally there's about 5 active sprints, what I've been seeing lately.
Wow. Okay. So 16 people supporting 5 active, you know, ish. I know there's a lot of variation, but 5-ish active projects. Yeah. So it sounds, and this like you have one person who's a lead on a given project and they stay relatively constant, but the other team members come and go. I'm going to assume here or project here a little bit. You can tell me if I'm right. So a lot of people will recoil to that. I slightly recoil against that just because like getting pulled on and off a project, it sounds like you lose kind of a lot of project specific knowledge, but because your team is so small and people tend to have a long tenure and you've really smoothed out, like you've really greased the wheels so that your team is running very, very well, that there's enough basically of similar work between projects that it's kind of that getting put in on a project in 2 weeks, it takes very little time for someone to get up to speed. And it's actually at that point, just kind of fun. Like, oh, like what's unique about this particular project? And so people, it's not frustrating for people to come on and off in that amount of time. It's more fun. Is that a good way to put it?
That's a good way to put it. I wouldn't say that's exactly reality. So we're also, you know, internally doing feedback and figuring out that, you know, jumping within the project is not very popular.
Right.
Per se. Particularly from the support perspective. So what we're doing better this year is we're having this project in support phase more organized. So we know how much support to expect and we allocate for that within a year. Because what, you know, tended to happen in the past is, you know, you're working in coding one project and, you know, in the middle of the week, some like one day of support for some past project jumps in. And that's not really nice for everyone involved. So we're improving that. But generally from the engineering perspective, we're a tight enough team that no one is far from the project, because we still have internal design feedback sessions. So for example, for firmware, we do once or twice a week, like a general Q&A session between the firmware team where people say, hey, I need help with this project, you know, review my code and so forth. Also, one of the parts, maybe firmware specific, that's really happening is people who are not working on the project are reviewing the code. So someone that might come up next week has been at least reviewing the pull request. So they understand the general structure, they know the architecture, general pitfalls. So it's more about scaling the effort and versus, hey, I have no idea what's happening here.
I would like to ask a bit more about the role of that project lead. So is that, I imagine that's not really a traditional product owner type role. How do you organize the, you know, this sort of integrating function, let's call it?
Right. So actually, that's a very new role, which we've just started adding to projects. Because previously, we've just had engineers assigned to the project. And you know,
and then Musti did everything else.
To an extent. So we do, there's myself and another colleague called Luca as well. So yeah, things don't get confusing ever. But we mostly talk to the clients and then translate that to the engineering team, because we don't want to bother them too much with the client engagements. The downfall of that is that not all the contextual information gets transferred to the team. So we're now including one of the engineering team into also discussions with the client. So they get the software part, like the software parts of the decisions, because we need to make a lot of judgment calls pretty much in the design. Like, is this getting too hard, or is this feature becoming like too expensive for the client? So maybe we shouldn't put too much effort on it. And, you know, really picking directions there. And we want everyone to be up to speed enough that they can autonomously make that decisions. So at least someone in the engineering team per project understands the, you know, nitty gritty details of the project, not just technically, but also from the customer requirement side.
So in other words, that is kind of a product owner role.
It is, but with not much time allocated to doing the product ownership except being present.
All right, I see. And I imagine that architectural decisions sort of get made between the engineers, so there's no person with the role of like an architect or something of that nature, right?
No, so we involve pretty much everyone in the beginning to figure out the best architecture, because we try to do as many of similar projects. So we do, you know, IT connected products, mainly in Zephyr RTOS, you know, with some Linux components and, you know, some front end, back end, server side things. We mostly do the same thing. So, you know, you do Bluetooth, you do Wi-Fi, you do NB-IoT, LTM, sensors, this and that. But we're also building quite a few internal components. So from the firmware perspective, we're building Irnas Zephyr libraries for, you know, state management or for messaging or for events or drivers for some communication protocol. And that gets transferred from project to project and also iterated from project to project. And that's a key benefit. Particularly for the connected products we've seen is, you know, if you have a company and you hire a team, you know, build us a connected device, they need to learn potentially about the new technology. They need to fully master it, implement it, and they deal with it on one project. So you only encounter so many issues, errors, problems. We do that on, you know, like 20 projects a year. So we've seen most things on Bluetooth, for example, because it's in most projects. So it gets a lot easier that way. And that's also what we kind of suggest to our clients is, you know, you work with someone that really turns around these things daily, the technologies you need. And then you have your internal team, which is focused mostly on like long-term maintenance and features and making that fit to your business case. Because the bulk of work you need to push the product out in, you know, half a year or a year, you don't need that scale necessarily all the time in-house, unless you're building new products nonstop, which is not the case for most of our clients.
How have your customers reacted to this? Basically, is there something you, is this part of your marketing, this way of working is, and kind of once you get into those initial negotiations with customers, how do they react to the way you structure your projects?
Right. So again, there's like two tiers here. So there's quite some clients that have been working with us since before we started officially doing this way. Anyway, even before we were effectively doing, you know, sprints, we just cut the project up into smaller deliverables and milestones, which were about that. We just didn't give it the name. So for those, this was a natural, you know, trust-based relationship. You know what you're doing, so we're happy with it. Mm-hmm. For new clients, it was quite surprising that everyone seems to get it. So I did expect a lot more pushback on it. But yeah, particularly larger corporations we work with were very happy and, you know, keen to start on this without too many questions asked. And this has really shown over the past year. We had some really good projects which progressed super fast because of that. And if we were to do it the traditional way, particularly, you know, with the large corporates, it would go quite horribly, because what we all believed in the beginning needed to be done is not what needed to be done for the project. You know, for example, you know, we started on the ML side, building the embedded ML algorithm for, you know, detecting some things. Then we figured out that their current hardware solution doesn't work very well for the quality of data collected. So we've immediately brought in the hardware team to redesign the hardware and, you know, test it out if we get better data collection through that. And that worked well. So we've done a few iterations there. And then we figured we need better tooling for the data collection process. So we built like an internal smartphone app that talks to the embedded device that collects the data, does the labeling. So you get the bulk for the ML. Then that got integrated into the hardware product. And then we ended the project versus the initial task. Let's create an ML model and put it on some existing piece of hardware. Didn't turn out to be that. But if your purchase order said that, it's hard to go stuff that actually needs to be done.
Yeah, so then so that begs the question, if you're willing to talk about it, how does that affect basically your pricing model? Like, do you sell sprints? Do you give estimates? How does that work?
Sure. So we sell sprints. So we do fixed cost per sprint. And we, to the best of our ability, estimate how many sprints will be required for this. And then we make clients choose. Either we do a fixed number of sprints, and then it's up to the client to listen to our feedback and decide what features they want. And the rule of thumb there is, what we're trying to achieve is really to, in 50% of the sprints, come up with an end-to-end working solution and use the rest of the 50% to add features and improve it. Because usually what happens otherwise, and happens also still quite often, is that 50% gets stretched to 60 or 70. So adding features at the end is quite a slim part. And that's usually where you get most business value. Doing like DFUs and setting up the project and doing all of the due diligence stuff you need to do for making something practical takes a lot of effort. And we want to make sure that's not too big part of the project. And the other way of working is, we say, we need 5 to 10 sprints roughly for what you need. We'll aim for 5 and see if you need extra stuff, or see if you say, we need this feature no matter the effort or cost. Then we just go all in and, do as much work as possible. Or is like, this feature is way harder than we all expected, so we'll park it and do some other feature.
One other thing that I've been really curious about is, so far we've been talking about the forward direction, the direction of creating stuff. But I would be really curious to hear about your approach to the feedback direction, verification, validation, testing, conversations with users or end users, clients, whoever. How do you know whether you're going in the right direction, whether you're done? How does that work, especially at such a breakneck pace?
That's a big challenge, and that's where things can go wrong quite badly. So from our perspective, that is the role of the product owner on the client side, and the client side, to understand what they need and their users need. What we do, however, is prompt them and also work with a partner of ours to do as much of usability engineering as possible in the first or early sprints. So usability engineering per se is what you generally see like in medical products and so forth, because it's one of the certification requirements that the product meets usability standards. But what also happens there is they will bring usability experts in at the end of the project where they need to do the certification part. So they're like, the product is defined, but we'll change some colors here and make the prompts, closer to what the standard says, versus doing the usability in day one. So restarting with the usability research, figuring out what do users actually need. And we really prefer in projects if we can work with a team that deals with usability and we work in parallel to them to support building the mock-ups, the prototypes, the concepts in the first sprints that we can give to the usability team that they can take to the users to see if that's what they want and take that feedback and create it. So you need to do way less usability if you do that as the first thing versus if you do that as the last thing where you can just change the details because you've done most of the rest, so you can't really change much.
But imagine you also have things like automated tests, especially if you do so many board spins, for instance.
Yes, that that's why the concept is we want to test things from day one. So we want to build as many automated tests as part of the development process. So we want to make that the least a separate thing than just the way of engineering. The challenge there is, however, because a lot of test-driven development tends to be quite slow, or at least perceived like that. So on one hand, you want to build the minimum amount of overhead to be fast. And on the other side, whatever you don't build on overhead kind of comes after you because you get stuck solving a bug or something doesn't work. So there's always this trade-off, and we try to find ways to make this all automated and just be second nature, but also not to do too much of that. And that's the constant dialogue between the engineers wanting to do all of it and the management wanting to do none of it. So we land in the middle.
And imagine with 20 projects a year, that's a lot of opportunity for feedback within your business. Correct. On how did this step of that, how did the entire project go? How did this step of that project go? You've got a lot of opportunities to improve the other projects you're working on concurrently and the next one coming in the pipeline.
Indeed. So I would say we're, really bad at internal feedback at the moment. We're trying to get better, to do retrospectives or things like that. Mm-hmm. But even without doing that officially, the experience is gained from one project to the other. So you do not repeat the mistake again. You find out what are good ways of doing things and you keep improving them. Particularly from the engineering perspective, it might look, slow and frustrating compared to, some projects or, some companies that do one project a year. You learn way less there because you just have way less opportunities.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? You need to be agile the agile way. You need to iterate on the way you're working.
Correct.
So how is it? So your company is based in Slovenia. How is it working there? And my understanding, you have a very young team. Kind of tell us about maybe the challenges specific to that.
Sure. So we're based in Maribor in Slovenia, which is a really nice place to be in. So we are proud of our good quality of life and a nice environment we have. But also it's the environment where there's not a lot of high tech companies. So there's not an abundance of engineers available. What we do that's reasonably unique in the space is we work with a young team. Also, the team kind of grows with the company as well in age, but we are adding students through our education program. So we work with students already from the university and we offer them scholarships and various learning programs or come work with us and learn things, do bachelor's, master's projects, all of that. So over 3 to 5 years while going to the university, they're already part of the company and they gain experience, real world projects and all of that. So the first day of real job coming through the door, we've already trained them up to the standard we need them to be. And that's a perfect opportunity for us and also for them to be able to learn and see the real world, which is a lot different to the university.
That is one, especially for a team with 16 engineers and not many non-engineers. It's a wonderful way to give back, and it's a great long-term view of things. That's an impressive level of investment.
Indeed, but also I believe it's the only way how to do it because, for example, we, at least on the embedded side, or if we talk about the firmware, we work on Zephyr RTOS. Overall, there's not many people in the world that are good at this. So it's close to zero chance we can find someone that has 5 years of working experience in our local environment,
right,
working on that. I don't know of any other people doing it. As simple as that.
And for you, remote work does not make sense. I mean, it is such a vital part of your company culture that everyone is in the same room and that communication is instantaneous and fluid.
Indeed. So, COVID kind of forced us to do remote work and we've done parts of it in the past. given that we are not like a remote default company as some are, it's really hard to do being like fully remote with a mostly in office team. So either you're like everyone is fully remote or everyone is mostly in the office. So what we do is we support working from home and remote work occasionally, or you know, if it does not need too much coordination, to everyone here in our team, but also having them on site for most of the time. Do keep in mind that this is quite special in the place we live. You know, Maribor is the second largest city in Slovenia, but it's reasonably small. So most commute times are under 10 or 12 minutes for most of the team. So that's not the massive hour, 2 hour long overhead as you have in some other places.
So mostly we've been talking a lot about how far you've come already, which is frankly quite impressive. But I'm wondering what is next on your roadmap? You know, where is the process still, you know, where could it improve? Where could, I don't know, more tools help? Where could more technology help? Where could more libraries help? I don't know.
Sure. So there's, you know, a bit of self-feedback. We know our internal processes aren't as defined as we would like them. We can make things more fluid. So just having a really nice, organized, documented way of working. So we're striving to improve that over time. But the general like technology space challenge we see is the lack of good end-to-end tools and like all the diversity there. So the business challenge we have is we need to somehow charge our clients to build the tools that make the whole process more efficient, which is, you know, either automation pipelines for building firmware or for deploying hardware or for automated testing and so forth. Charging that to one client for everything that one client needs is beyond any client's capacity. So what we can do efficiently on our side is develop the tools over time and, you know, use bits of effort from every client to improve them and give the whole tool back to the client so they can use it in their process. So from that perspective, we've created like a ZPT tool, which is a rack test unit for automated board testing. We're creating Zephyr RTOS libraries and so forth. So we haven't made all of that public and available yet, but we're over time releasing that through our GitHub. The like industry challenge is you don't get all of these tools from vendors of whatever you're using most of the time. Like things are getting better, but compared to, you know, software development tool sets, everything from like debugging, error reporting, testing, like there's just so much for smartphone apps and websites and all that. On the hardware level, this is like really crude. You know, it's, if we compare it to the Stone Age, we're still hitting with a stone instead of a hammer or some, you know, electric precision tool, God forbid. So,
printf debugging should be good enough for everyone.
Yeah. And, you know, even if you look like at, you know, GDB debugging and all that, there's some nice tools out there, but I would say none of it had really good usability engineering and like proper product development, which figured out how to make people use it faster and efficient. And, you know, you take it in your hand and do it. For example, a nice way where things are happening and giving a shout out to the team at Memfault is they do this remote debugging piece of software you can inject in your firmware. And this is like mind-blowing for the firmware space, but for the smartphone apps, there's like just so many things you can use and you get all the crash logs and everything. It just magically appears. So as the software world has it, on the firmware side, it's just starting.
Yeah, we've had Francois from the CEO of Memfault on the show. That episode has not published yet as of this recording. But he talked about, I think it was at Pebble that he first basically had this idea. And he looked over at what the app people were doing and said, how do you guys solve this problem? They're like, what are you talking about? We have all these tools. It's wonderful. And he's like, wait. So he essentially made it his mission to bring that level of introspection and remote monitoring and debugging to the firmware side. And they've been doing great work.
Exactly. And, you know, this is one company and we need like 100 of those for the
right. Yeah, phase. They're solving one particular slice, and yes, they'll grow it over time. But there's so many aspects of that of firmware development that need that kind of dedicated tooling and really built in a customer first way.
Indeed, and maybe you know one specific way we found, particularly because we work with low power devices most of the time, is measuring power of every firmware build you do. So we have this, you know, on desk power measurement devices with programmers and everything on there. And like, you need to flash the device, you need to relay switch off all the programming lines so they're not drawing power, and have the right, you know, piece of software test there. So you see, you don't break low power because you've added, you know, one line in piece of software somewhere, which does not break the software in any way or the firmware in the device. Like, everything still works. It just uses like 1,000 times the power. And for a battery powered device, that's the death of it, essentially.
Yeah. And if you're not measuring that, that's the difference between project failure and project success. And it's sitting on your desk still working. And if you're not measuring it, you don't know.
But the point is, if you measure this at the end where you've done the development, and it's not low power, then you're in on the deep end. Like, everything could be the problem. So you really need to check it every firmware build flash, you know, constantly. So at least when it's not, you can go back. I think this broke it. And then you look at it.
Got it. Cool. Luca, anything else you want to ask Musi before we wrap it up?
Oh, millions of things, but I think it's about time we ended this episode.
So Musi, tell everyone how they can get in touch with you and find out more about you and more about Earnest.
Perfect. So feel free to head to earnest.eu website where you can find all the things about us, or you can email me directly at luca.mustafa@earnest.eu, and I'll try to get back to you as soon as possible.
And obviously those links will be in the show notes.
Sorry, I think I said Gmail or Earnest. I'm not sure, but yeah.
I think at earnest.eu. I think that's what I heard. So I think that was correct.
Perfect.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was a fantastic conversation and very enlightening.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. This has been the Agile Embedded Podcast. I'm Jeff Gable.
And I'm Luke Njani.
And we will see you all next time. Thank you.